Greetings.
Greetings. It's still there. I'm gonna try and ignore it. I'll let you know if it gets to a point where I can't hear anything. That would be unfortunate. Mm-hmm.
Tell me, where are we going to go?
Well, I want to understand what the vortex and chakra really means, and okay, understand more.
Okay, as I mentioned last time we met, maybe it's easiest to start with you telling me what you already understand.
Yeah.
Because that will refresh your mindset on everything. And it will also streamline your ideas so that we can easily build up on them.
Yeah. So it's very difficult to explain what I think because I don't really understand much, I feel.
Just start.
So, basically, I've always wondered what there is, you know, more. What is everything made of? What are we? What are we made of? Everything. Never really had anyone explain it to me. Mm-hmm. It's been more focused on religion and, you know, God and creation in that sense. And I never really connected with that. I didn't really feel that that was it. Mm-hmm. So I've always wondered what there is more. And now I feel that I have a glimpse of what it could be. I have no idea what yet. I don't understand. But I feel that this is what I have been looking for. Mm-hmm. And this, I can't explain. I asked to know more about chakras, and you started explaining to me what a vortex is. And to me, vortex was before just patterns in nature. That was like kind of it, what I knew. Now I see those patterns as spirals of the vortex. Or vortices, and the vortices is what is, it's everything, it's what everything's made up of, it's constantly moving and evolving and spinning and creating creation, which I don't understand, but somehow it's very complicated, but somehow it all makes sense. And that's where I am.
Okay, perhaps it's the more practical to sidestep chakras and vortices for a moment. I already mentioned that there is something like called tetrionics. Do you have a notion of the concept of tetrionics?
No.
Then I suggest that I give you a brief understanding of tetrionics as I came to know it and why it appeals to me so much. Before I can go into tetrionics, and I would need to go back to how I basically went to discover exactly the question that you have in mind. What is this all and how does it come to be? And what do we do within all of this? That'll be quite a story. Is that okay?
Oh, I love it.
So, in my mind, let me then go back. Take you back to where I was when I was, say, around 11, 12 years old, in the Brooks in Austria, where my parents had a holiday home rented for the summer vacation. And I didn't have much else to do than put rocks in the brook and discover that at some points the brook would stop and sort of linger where the dam of rocks was, and sometimes the rocks would be pushed aside by the river, which just took a different flow form and then found its way again. That led me to go to the Mecca of hydrodynamics, which, as far as I knew and as far as the world seemed to know, was the Department of Civil Engineering in Delft University in the Netherlands. And when I arrived there, I was very disappointed, because I realized that they did not have a basic understanding of what it is and how it comes to be and what our role is within it all. Nevertheless, I stayed there, basically because my father thought that I should have a diploma, and basically because I realized that wherever else I would go, I would probably run into the same problem. So I decided to do their studies, but also mine. So I just played along with what they were doing, but also kept on looking at everything else, how it all connects. The most important part of what I learned there is what I explained to you last time when you recorded this session on what is science. Because I learned that classical science basically describes matter, but also discovered that matter is composed of molecules, so that actually the description of classical science does not apply too much, because molecules work in different ways. Where classical science says everything is inert and predictable, so you can repeat an experiment, you can validate it, and you can predict things from that. That stops happening at the moment that you start looking at the dynamic of molecules. And essentially, the theory of Einstein is based on molecular motion, quite literally, because he started his equation from the perspective of what is called the Zitterbewegung, which is the Brownian motion of seeds of grass and water. They sort of bounce around a bit up and down with respect to each other. And now we know that that has to do with electromagnetic forces around the seed and the surface tension of the water and more things. But for the theory of relativity, it was actually the first attempt to describe the movement of molecules as something which at that time could not be seen. And which led to a theory which is quite useful and basically described everything in terms of movements. People like Fourier had already sort of looked into that when they looked at how do waves go up and down. And then some other people, Lobachev and Riemann, decided, well, if you can look at it as waves, you can also look at it as cycles. So Einstein essentially used that mathematical cycles, as a result of which a lot of people got confused, because then they ended up with this question, if you look at a circle, is it a wave or is it a particle? Which then they sort of said that applied to the photon, but essentially that whole misunderstanding came from the model of the mathematics that was being used, in which circles, yes, if you sit on the outside of the circle, it looks like a particle. And if you're inside a circle or on the edge of it, you see it go up and down like a wave. So the model actually explained a lot of things, but not enough. And so science discovered that molecules are actually composed of atoms. As I said, that's already something the Greeks realized, because the word atomos means the uncuttable, because they wondered, if you have anything, say a piece of cheese, and you cut it, then what would the smallest bit of cheese look like? So they came to the notion that there's something, the smallest part of cheese and the smallest part of cucumber and the smallest part of water and the smallest part of anything. Evidently, when the notion of molecules came in and the notion of atom came in, it was discovered that at the atomic level, basically there is 120 atoms that you can choose from, You can combine them in different ways. They can link up, yes or no, and form these things which you call molecules, and those can again form these things we call matter. So when I studied this stuff in engineering school, everybody was describing matter using these classical models, and then occasionally they would change to the relativistic model, but not quite aware of where they were doing it. So most often they looked at that for electromagnetic flows, and actually the flow of electromagnetism is the flow of electrons in matter, which is chemistry. So that's no longer physics. But then of course they also realized that they should not actually look at the flows of electrons, but the movement of electrons themselves and the jumps of electrons, which is then called quantum theory at the atomic level. But for what I knew, there was something amiss with that theory, because evidently there are subatomic particles, and if you can describe atoms in terms of, say, little galaxies, then what are you dealing with? Because at the smallest levels you have protons, neutrons and electrons, but there's something amiss with that model, because just imagine that you have this model of an atom as they describe it. So basically you have a football, and 27 kilometers further down you have a tennis ball circling it, and that would then be the model of the smallest atom. And then of course you get the question, well, if an atom needs to go from one orbit in an atom to another, just imagine that you're playing billiards, and then you have this, say this football 27 kilometers further down, you have this tennis ball circling around it, and in one way or the other you need to move the electrons from one orbit to another. Then that means that you need to be very good at your billiard ball playing, because somehow you need to shoot a photon against this electron and hit it at the precise spot while it is circling with light speed around this atomic nucleus, and you need to give your billiard ball the right spin so that it jumps from one orbit to the other. So for me that didn't compute, because I cannot foresee that everywhere in the universe everything would work with that kind of precision. Things at light speed, no. And there was also something else which I thought was problematic, because if the universe is indeed composed of electrons and protons, then by the principle of electricity, the plus and the minus would find each other and immediately annihilate each other. So I imagine if the universe started, the first thing that happens in the protons and electrons are created, they're opposite charges, they look each other up, they find each other, and they're gone again. So that doesn't work, because the beginning of the universe would be an explosion which just continues and leads to nothing. Annihilation of plus and minus being zero. The other problem would be that if you look at electromagnetism, then everything electric in motion will create magnets. But then at that level, if you have magnets floating around in this fresh and young boisterous universe, then the plus pole would find the north pole and they would happily stick together forever. And in that approach, everything magnetic would mean that the universe at the moment that it was created would freeze over straight away. So later on I described that in a text called Bio-Holograms. Basically say, well, the model that we have from science is wrong, because either it's electric and then everything just goes up in fire, or it is magnetic and everything freezes into a clump. And as we know, that's not happening. So I was realizing that the models that were being offered were not very useful, and also I realized that the model which supposedly had to save the day didn't describe anything. because one day I had realized that the classical system, the classical theory described matter, and then realized that matter was actually molecules, and you needed the relativistic model with movement with respect to something else, which is then limited by the event horizon. And then they discover that actually it is not about that, but it's about atoms and the jumps of electrons associated with the jumps of photons. But then it means that the whole universe is electromagnetic, and that the quantum jump is actually the limit of anything. But at the moment that you turn a quantum over, you've already gone beyond the event horizon, and you already ran into a different reality than the one that the classical theory described. So they realized that there was something there, and the conclusion was then it's necessary to look at the deeper level where protons, electrons, and neutrons and photons are all vibrations. So that's where they came up with string theory, and essentially said that everything that we know is a vibration. Which makes sense, because if you look at the world around us, and we are still talking about the chakra system, but we're now at the deep end of it. If you look at the world around us, then everything around us is vibrations, and the only thing that we experience is this bath of vibrations as it impinges on us at the surface of our body. And all the cells respond to it, but some cells respond to the one thing more than the other. So similar to the way that in our body we have different organs, which all complement each other and together make this zodiac cycle of the gods of the Olympus, in which an internal food chain can cycle around, with different organs which each complement each other. And so every organ does another part of what needs to be done. And physics you would call that a spectrum analysis. So you have a spectrum, the whole range of what is done with these organs processing this food and information. And then you sort of slice and dice it up between the organs and see that everyone does a part of it. But I realized that on the outside we see the same. So on the inside we have the liver, we have the heart, we have the stomach, we have the gut, we have the kidneys, and so on. And actually the brain is a mirror image of all of that. But on the outside we have the mirror image again of what happens in the brain in the form of the sensory system. And so there are cells which respond to light, there are cells that respond to electromagnetic radiation. For example, in the nose we detect infrared waves, on the tongue we detect molecular association, in the nose we call it molecular molecular association. That's where the molecules touch the surface of the body, and as a result they have a kind of affinity because of all the electric interactions that can take place. And on the tongue, which is actually part of the gut, we have the molecular dissociation, because on the tongue the molecules are sort of falling apart already. So the electromagnetic forces of the molecules are sort of sensed in a different way, and then we call them salt or sweet or bitter and so on. But just like we have the salt, bitter, sweet and so on the tongue, we also have the light that we have in the eyes, the smell, the taste in the nose and the tongue, and we have the sound as we have it in hearing. But all of those are vibrations. So string theory and superstring theory said, well, if everything is vibrations, we need to describe it in that manner. And we need to come down to an understanding that we stop talking about the sensory system, we stop talking about the organs, but we try to find out what is this alphabet of vibrations and how do they all connect up. And in that approach there is an interesting theory by a French guy called de Broglie, and he basically said that the universe is like music. Pythagoras 2000 years ago had already said something like that. He already said that everything is vibration. So in a way, modern science, most modern science, was as antique as antiquity. So they then had this model of vibrations, and Broglie said, if you calculate the wavelength of the planets around the sun, then you can see that one planet has the wavelength with one number, and then the next planet is on the next wavelength out, and the next one is on the next wavelength out. So he could actually calculate the wavelength around the sun and confirm that that's where you find the planets, and also that's where you can confirm that there is a non-planet, which is Marduk, or the exploded planet, which is now called the asteroid belt. But of course, if you can use this approach of wavelength 1, wavelength 2, wavelength 3, wavelength 4 for all of the planets, and Pythagoras essentially already said that the planets were arranged by frequencies and numbers, but then of course you can also say the same for the atoms. So then the electron would be on orbit 1, orbit 2, orbit 3, orbit 4, and the only way that the electron would move from one orbit to the other is if it could go from wavelength 1 to wavelength 2, or the other way around. But that means that in going from one orbit to the other, the electron would have to make an extra turn. Because if you have a wavelength of say a number, any number, and in mathematics you call it number n of the number, then the next wavelength out would be n plus 1. The next wavelength inwards would be n minus 1. But so if the electron goes from n to n plus 1, it somehow needs to add another spin to its own rotations, to its own movement. And for me that meant that if that is the case, then the quantum leap, which is what they used to describe the transition of electron from one orbit to the other, must be a change of spin, a change of phase. It needs to go from n to n plus 1 or n to n minus 1, which means that there is a number 1 of spin which needs to be accounted for. So what I've just described is, say, the conventional model of science. And I realized that in this conventional model of science there were a couple of problems. One, that everything electric will explode as soon as it is made because of the plus and the minus annihilating. Everything magnetic will sort of freeze over, and because of the North Pole and South Pole connecting up. And of course it's very funny because when they say when hell freezes over, hell must be by definition a cold space, because it is a frozen state of a non-changing state. And the only way you can have that in nature would be if it is frozen. So that would be the magnetic side of the story. And of course, purgatory, where all the flames are, is where you would have the electric part of the story, where never anything will come to rest. So I was looking for something to explain how the electron could go from one orbit to the other and actually need to do an extra spin to go from the one orbit to the other, and that is what people associate with the photon. Actually, I might as well just add something in there which is quite interesting, which is that at the moment that the Earth rotates around the Earth, around the Sun, then in a year time the Earth will have rotated 365 days around the Sun, but in turning around the Sun it will also have turned once around its own axis. Because if the Earth was not rotating, then by going from one side of the Sun, say turning right, being on the opposite side, turning left and coming back, you have the sun on, say, the top of the earth, on the left of the earth, on the bottom of the earth, and on the right of the earth. So it will have made a rotation around its axis with respect to the sun. So astrology knows that as a day equals a year. And this kind of activity is also seen at the level of the electron going from one orbit to the other. It needs to rotate around its own axis in order to be able to go from one level to the other in the atomic orbits. This picture has a problem because, as I said, by the principle of the billiard balls, how ever can a photon connect up to these electrons while they are racing around at the speed of light around this little mini galaxy of the atom? So I was looking for a way to describe that, and I realized that if this needed to work, then it needed to have a tetrahedral shape somewhere in there for the photon, for simple principles of symmetry and axial rotations and all that. So I started to look on the internet, and then I ended up finding tetrionics. So I can now replace this whole story that I told you, which I had to discover by going to engineering school and reading their stories or fairy tales or beliefs about how matter, molecules, atoms, and vibrations are all interrelated. And I discovered that in Australia there was this guy, Calvin Abrahams, who had solved all of the problems that I had found in all of these theories. And the fun part is that he had started with a totally opposite point of view. So at this point I'd like to present to you the newest model of science that I know of, and which is the only model that I know of which has the paradigm shift that is needed. And a couple of years ago I wrote a text called the Paradigm Shift, What is Necessary to Get Science Out of the Trap That It Is In. And it turns out that this guy in Australia had solved all of that in a model that he calls tetrionics. So let me now switch to the next topic, which is that of tetrionics, and summarize what Calvin Abraham told me. He was looking, let me go back a bit. He was working with the fire department of where he was living, and he was doing the radio communication systems. So his spiel was electronics. So he knew how to do the calculations, and knew how to work with the technology. And at some point, with his son, he was talking about the pyramids. His son asked, what about these pyramids? So Calvin started to draw a triangle, and suddenly from somewhere, he had this picture of a radio diagram, which is the essence of everything that you do with radio circuits. He saw that sort of superimposed on this triangle. And that led to a totally new approach of science. So let me reconstruct science from the perspective as he recreated it. His starting point was that he knew that science had discovered that matter is molecules, molecules is atoms, and atoms are moved by the quantum leap, the quantum jump. Science says that that's how an electron can go from one orbit to the other, as a result of which the electron can have a different charge in the atom, and the atom can have a different charge with respect to another atom. Thereby atoms can connect up, they can form molecules, they can form matter. For Calvin, the conclusion was, well, if it all starts with the quantum, then why don't we start the whole description with the quantum? And there he had this picture of the short circuit of the shape of the pyramid with this electrodynamic diagram on top of it. So he started with the picture of a quantum in the form of an equilateral triangle. a very simple, straightforward equilateral triangle. All sides are the same, but there is a movement. If you think it back a bit, then what he basically came up with was a rather funny solution, because he said, well, at the basis, the electron and the proton, or the plus and the minus charges, must be connected. And as I said earlier, we can also look at them as part of a vortex. But if you look at them at the most basic level of description, then let's say you have the pixel of the universe. As you said, we're talking about the universe being created. So the pixel of creation is this little point which is at the same time plus and minus. This point is in movement. So as it is moving, it will trace a line. So you will have a point moving along a line. So it goes from the bottom of the line to the top of the line. But as it has two charges, electric charges, it will, by the law of electromagnetism, pull a magnetic wake behind it. And a bit like an airplane, when it flies, it will have a vortex spinning on the one direction of the one wing and another vortex spinning in the other direction from the other wing. And likewise, behind a point, plus and minus, in motion, there will be a vortex spinning the one way called the North Pole and a vortex spinning the other way called the South Pole. So if you look at it as the picture of an equilateral triangle, then say this point with the charge has moved from the bottom of the triangle to the top, and at the same time sideways the triangle has grown with the North Pole and the South Pole at the bottom of the picture of the triangle. So Kelvin was playing around with that for 6 years, and he realized that when you play with these triangles on the kitchen table, which literally he did, and then you can see that the magnetic side, which has a North Pole and a South Pole at the bottom of this triangle, could actually connect up to the magnetic side of another triangle facing the other direction. So after many experimentations, he realized that that was actually the picture of the photon. So then he had something very simple. He had a charge in motion going one way is a quantum. If two of those quanta connect up, and they basically don't move in one direction, but they become larger, it's an expansion, then we call it a photon. And that also means that the foundation of the universe is, say, a realm where we have all of these plus minus particles flipping around in movements that we cannot see, for the simple reason that they are two-dimensional. They're flat and we cannot detect them. And there's two kind of motions in that. One of them, they have a direction, and there's no symmetry in that. They just go away, go their way and go away. And that's called the quantum, or in a more general terminology, the boson. You also have those kind of quantum particles that connect up, and they go both ways. So they are symmetrical in their movement. And those are called a photon. So he then realized that there is a whole level of reality which is outside of our scope, which is simply an electromagnetic field composed of, in his model, triangles. And if you combine the triangles, then you get a rhombus shape, a diamond shape. So with the triangles for the quanta and the diamond shape for the photons, he then realized that there is an enormous electromagnetic field. And actually, if you understand the photon, a diamond composed of two of these triangles, as moving by, say, a magnetic receptor, then you will actually first see the charge of the first quantum come by, and then you see the charge of the second quantum come by. So you will actually detect exactly what had been measured, the electrical wave and then the magnetic wave, on which all of physics is based. So he had very neatly redefined everything in existence, but at the same time dematerialized everything. So what field theory sought to describe as pure vibrations, he showed as maps of triangles and diamond shapes all interconnected, with the accurate results for the measurement of a photon. So that was quite neat. And then after a while he realized that when playing around with these equilateral triangles, you can stick two of them together and then you have this photon, but you can actually stick four of them together as well, and then something changes because they're no longer in a plane. You can actually stick them together to form a tetrahedron. So that is one triangle, and you fold three triangles up so that they meet up at the top. And this tetrahedral shape is the smallest three-dimensional shape that you can imagine. So he then realized that if this model could work or would work, then this tetrahedron would be the smallest form of matter that exists. And be aware, you're now listening in on the newest form of science, which connects everything up with everything else. So at the level of the description of these bosons and photons, these quanta and these photons in the plane, he now had something new coming into the story, which is this tetrahedral shape of what he called a tetrion. So the theory tetrionics is named after this tetrahedral pack of four quanta, which of course is also the same as two photons connecting up to each other. So there is a simplicity in his model, because he started with this triangle. You can glue two triangles together by their magnetic field and then you end up with a photon, but you can also glue two photons together by their dynamic, and then you end up with a tetrion. Tetrion is composed of four of those triangles, but these triangles are say a point, a zero point in motion. That's actually where the whole zero point physics has now a very much better kind of description. So the zero point in motion has a plus charge and a minus charge. In the model of tetrionics, you see that as the triangle, of which the one side is plus and the other side is minus. So if you would flip over this triangle, you actually flip over the quantum and then you reverse the charge, and that's precisely what you need for the electron to go from one orbit to the other. So another whole lot of measurements fell into place. He also realized that if you have four of these equilateral triangles together in a tetrahedron, and all of these triangles have a plus charge on the one side and a minus charge on the other side, then there are four different patterns that you can have for this little tetrahedron. And the first solution is that it has minus charges on all sides, so it will have four times minus quantum charges, so it will have a minus charge. The alternative is that you flip it inside out, because the opposite side of the particle, say the antiparticle, would have pluses on all outsides, so that would be four plus quantum charges for this tetrahedral shape. But you can also imagine that there would be a combination where you flip the photons the other way around and you have two charges which are plus and two charges which are minus. Or if you turn it inside out, two charges which are minus and two charges which are plus. So out of the four combinations, two of them will be combinations of two plus and two minus, and two minus and two plus, and one will be 4 plus and one will be 4 minus. So suddenly there was a whole different kind of, say, technology of understanding subatomic physics. Because if everything material is composed of these little tetrahedral shapes, which have an electrical charge, then of course these electrical tetrahedrals can, by their charge, glue up to each other. So if you have one tetrahedron with its plus charge and you have a tetrahedral with a minus charge, then they can just stick together. And when the surfaces connect up like that, with the plus and the minus charge connecting, that now is the equivalent of what physics call the strong force. If the distribution is differently, then you can have, say, two plus sides and two minus sides on one particle, and two minus and two plus on the other, but then the ribs between the two plus sides and the rib between the two minus sides, they can connect up by the plus and minus charge. So it's now not the surface that will connect up, but it's the rib, the edge of the tetrahedral that will connect up with the plus and minus charge. And that is what physics call the weak force. But you can also imagine that the tetrahedron shape is four times plus and another is four times minus. And then they can even connect up at the tip. There's four tips, so by any of the four tips they can connect up in what physics calls the derived force. So with that in mind, Calvin was playing with these shapes on the kitchen table, and out of it came a whole series of little puzzle pieces that you could put together, and all of those are the subatomic particles as physics had already found them. But he had found them the other way around. He had started with these triangles and the photons and the electromagnetic field, which is flat in any whichever direction. He had come up with this tetrahedral shape, which is three-dimensional, which is the smallest bit of physical reality that we can imagine. But he also realized that all of the connection between these electric particles were due to the electromagnetic field. Because if you have four of these triangles connected up to each other, the form of the tetrahedron is inert, it's invariant, it cannot change, it is fixed. So matter in itself is totally fixed, there's nothing that can change that, unless it falls apart and lets go of all the energy that it has within it. And actually he says that around these triangles, of course, you have all these two-dimensional planes of electromagnetic fields crisscrossing all around it. So there is a lot of electromagnetic field energy around it, which is called the vacuum energy in space. It's called the vacuum because they cannot see that two-dimensional realm. But within the tetrions, these tetrions glue together because their dynamic keeps them repeating themselves, so to say. But it also means that within these particles there is nothing. Even the zero energy, the vacuum energy, is not there. And that is what he says is what gravity is. It's as if you have a balloon and you put it on the water, then the further you put it in the water, the smaller the balloon will come because there's so much water pressure around it. And in this case, in the tetrions, the shape is invariant, but the more electromagnetic field there is around it, the more you have what's called gravitational force on it. So suddenly, gravity came into the picture as well. And then I can make some large jumps. I needed to sort of spell this out bit by bit, because this is actually the whole magic of tetrionics, that you have electromagnetic fields, which some religions would call spirit or God or divinity or cosmic consciousness. You also have minute particles called tetrion, which in religion you would call manifestation, materialization. But now in tetrions you can see that the only thing that moves these particles is the same, the only thing that can form these particles, which is the electromagnetic field. So that changes the picture considerably, because now we don't have atoms, which are little planetary systems and we can't quite understand how they hang together, but instead there are minute little tetrahedral shapes, and the electromagnetic forces of the field will determine how they can connect up. By his kitchen table experiment, he came up with all these subatomic particles, and he also discovered that three particles are particularly interesting because of the specific kind of match that they have together. And that is that the form of the proton and the form of the neutron is identical. If you stick enough of these particles together, you need 12 of them, then you can fix them up in such a way that they have the same form, but the surfaces are different. As a result, for the neutron, the particles on the surface of the shape are balancing out with plus and minuses. That's why it's measured as a neutron, neutral force. But with the proton, on one surface, it is exactly the same but opposite as that of the neutron. But the other charges are different, as a result of which there is more positive charge for the thing as a whole. But that means that the one has a plus charge, the other has a cancelling out charge. But on one surface, by the strong force, they have a full match. And by the strong force, they can actually glue together. But imagine that a bit in the shape of having two dice of a game of dice, so two cubes with somewhat rounded edges, and you can stick them on top of each other, and when you stick them on top of each other, it's like between them they leave an opening on one side. And as he built all of this on his kitchen table, he just discovered that, he just stumbled into it. And he also discovered that the electron, which is a different shape. The electron is composed of three of these tetrions, and they sort of glue together on one of the sides of it. So they're a bit like a wheel, and they fit precisely between a proton and a neutron. So that makes a totally different picture of this foundation of an atom, because there you have a proton and a neutron, a bit like two dice on top of each other, or a bit like a battery, but halfway this battery there's a little wheel sticking out of it on one side, and it can rotate. It is magnetically captured, this electron is magnetically captured between the proton and the neutron, but it can turn around, and the quicker it turns, the more it is like a bicycle wheel. It will have inertia. A bicycle wheel, the quicker it turns, the more difficult it is to change its direction. And so in these atoms, likewise, you can have these electrons spinning around at very high speeds, depending on, a bit like a water wheel in a river, how fast the electromagnetic field is racing next to it. So out of that came a different picture of atoms, in which every atom is composed of a number of these, let's call it battery packs, plus, minus, and zero. And then every atom will have its what's called a Z number, and the Z number actually in tetrionics is the number of these battery packs. So there's no little galaxies, there's no little star systems, there's no little things running around without an explanation of why that would happen. The simple little battery packs with little spinning wheels on the inside of them, and when you stack them next to each other, and then on the kitchen table you can neatly show how they all fit together, but you can also show that you can only fit 120 of them. So in that approach, you always need to have a plus, a minus, and a zero together to form an atom. So hydrogen doesn't count as an atom. It simplifies the whole model of atomic physics immensely, because there are just these battery packs stuck together. And what he found in making this and mapping it is that because of these spinning electron wheels halfway this battery pack, the measurements which already existed of where is the electron with respect to the atom perfectly matched, because the wheel is sort of eccentric, and if you would not see that it is a battery pack with a spinning wheel halfway in it, but you sort of look at the top of it and you wouldn't see that it is a battery pack, but you were turning around, then you would see the electron tracing a circle around this battery pack, which you don't see. And so you end up with precisely the same finding as physics had, but also with exactly the same distances as physics has found. Not just that, but there are also measurements of the atomic nucleus, which are called the Schrödinger numbers. And in his maps, he could just show what the Schrödinger numbers were, and the Bohr radius, the distances of the electrons from the core, he could just show them in his maps. And so he had rediscovered everything that physics had found, but he had a totally different explanation. And that's also why I was totally fascinated. I interviewed the guy for a year and a half, found him to be a very friendly, a very patient, and very in-depth researcher. So he was able to see all of the books of physics, and where for me they didn't make sense, he was able to see where they made their mistakes and correct them and connect to them. So this is all described in the website called tetrionics.com. And my interviews with him are found on the website tetrionics.scienceoflife.nl, together with the notes of the interviews I had with him. So to round it off at this point, I ran into Tetrionics because I was looking for something that would explain how a photon could have a tetrahedral shape. I then discovered Tetrionics, which said that the photon cannot have a tetrahedral shape for the simple reason that it doesn't have a rest mass. So there is nothing physical. The only way that a photon can have every property that it has is if it is in a two-dimensional plane. And then the measurements for photons match up perfectly with this picture of it being composed of two quanta. Out of that then comes the realization that the smallest particle, which is tetrahedral, is not known as yet in physics, but it is the foundation of everything that is physical. And not just that, but there are two parts of it. One of them is that there is this set of tetrahedral shapes with plus charges and minus charges, actually four quantum plus charges and four quantum minus charges. But there is a whole lot of, say there's 50% of the universe which cannot be detected for the simple reason that its plus and minus charges cancel out. So 50% of the universe is electromagnetically indetectable by the methodology that we have now, because it's neutral charged, but at the same time it can participate in all of these electromagnetic reactions of the strong force, the weak force, and the drive force, by which is tetrahedral shapes can together build up subatomic particles, atoms, and those can then combine to form molecules of matter. At this point, I would like to add a bit to the picture of Tetrionics as I got to know it through Calvin Abraham. And that is that there is a relationship between the tetrion and the vortex. And so we are now connecting this story back up to your question, what about these vortices and how does that have to do with the creation of the universe as a whole. The quickest shortcut in those two understandings lies in the model of the bathtub of which you pull the plug. I already mentioned that if you pull the plug of a bathtub, then the volume of the water will flow from the surface and down along the stream line of the vortex out through the hole, the point where the plug is. So there you see the relationship between the three-dimensional volume of the water, the two-dimensional surface of the water, the one-dimensional, the line form of the streamline of the vortex, and the turning point, the zero point where the vortex turns inside out and disappears into the sewer system and back into the ocean, back into the hydraulic circulation on that planet. That relationship between the point, the line, the plane, and the volume is also what you find in the tetrahedron. If you have a point, and take that as a starting point, then from that point you can trace a line. So from zero-dimensional point you go to a one-dimensional line. If you then make a triangle, then suddenly you have a plane, two-dimensional. And if you add another point to that, then you will have a tetrahedron. So by simply having 1 point, 2 point, 3 point, and 4 points, you can connect them up from a point to a line, from a line to a plane, from a plane to a volume. But that's exactly the same story as that of the vortex. In other words, you can represent a vortex by a tetrahedron, once you understand the principle's connectedness. So you can interpret the tetrahedron to be an equivalent expression of a vortex, or let's call it half a vortex, because of course if you pull the plug in the bath, then the other half of the vortex has a different kind of shape, because it actually goes from the plug through the whole line of the sewage system into the surface of the river, into the volume of the ocean. But the main notion is that you can equate the vortex to the triangle, to the tetrahedron. And that is where you can then connect up to this whole principle of creation, in as it is described by Tetrionics, and understand that it is just a different way of describing how the universe can be imagined to be created by the principle of a vortex. So maybe this is a good point to have a to sort of close this off for the moment, so that we can then connect it back up to your growing understanding on this. Let me just briefly summarize. I started with the notion of the vortex, but I now connected that to the understanding of tetrionics. In order to do that, I first had to connect up to how I got to know material science and realize that actually classical theory needed to be replaced by relativity theory of molecules, which then needed to be replaced by the quantum theory of atoms, which then needed to replace by the string theory of the subatomic vibrations. But now there is a different theory which connects it all together, which starts with the subatomic field of electromagnetic vibration, which is called the quantum field. And then from the quantum field you can see how the smallest forms of matter can be created. You can also understand that the only way that these particles can move is by the electromagnetic field. In classical theory it would be said God moves it all. It's the electromagnetic field that moves it all. And that everything that comes into existence emerges out of the interactions of the electromagnetic field with these minute particles of the tetrahedral tetrions.